The following programming is sponsored by Doreen Taylor Music, LLC. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Peasley Media Group. What's going on?
Hey, hey, USA, what is going on? Welcome to The Scene with Doreen. I'm your host, Doreen Taylor, setting the scene every week to help you find out what's happening in music, TV, movies, sports, the arts, and everything in between. We're proud to be syndicated on stations coast to coast and originating right here in the city of brotherly love on Philadelphia's number one talk radio station, Talk 860 WWDB. Get insider access and go behind the scene on our show's official website, thescenewithdoreen.com, and watch us each and every week on the nationally syndicated television show The Daily Flash, available in every major city in the U.S. And strike a pose, Matt. Are you ready? Click, 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 click. I need to put like a camera. Ching,
ching, ching. I don't think that works on a radio.
You could probably inject like a sound clip in there.
No, I'm saying you say strike a pose.
Like, you can't see it, right?
If I'm still, nobody knows.
Well, you know, maybe you are. In radio land, he's doing it right now. See, they don't know that you're not. Now they do. He is. Now he's frozen and he's not moving. So the show is not going to go any further, apparently.
Okay.
But hi, Matt.
How you doing?
Good. I bring up striking a pose because today is a whole kind of cool thing about photography.
Yes.
We don't normally do that here.
No, not usually talk about photography. It's usually about music or, you know, other types of media.
Movies.
Or entertainment.
Yeah, but you know what? Also photography. If you're a rock and roll photographer and you've taken photos of some of the most iconic legends that have ever graced the stage, then it sort of is in our wheelhouse.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Everything's intertwined.
It is, you know, but it got me thinking, you know, we're talking about photography and these really iconic shots. We're talking like John Lennon in the New York City t-shirt on the top of a rooftop and all these amazing photos that are in our brain that we've seen. But these were important works of art at one point. And now we all have these cameras. We all have it in our phone. I'm picking up my phone. No one can see this, but I'm like waving my little Samsung around. And it's like, have we sort of diluted memories by taking too many photos? We're thinking we're, you know, making everything a memory by taking photo. But are we actually diluting it a little bit?
I think in a way, just because it's so convenient now to take a picture. Mm-hmm. You could take a picture of anything. I mean, you could just walk down the road and, oh, that's pretty cool, take a picture.
Yeah,
back
yeah.
then, I mean, it was actually work in a way to get a good shot.
Yeah.
I mean, you would see in, I'm sure, like, even when you were in school, I took a photography class and we had to go in a dark room.
Oh, there were dark
and
rooms,
develop the film.
Oh, and you had to wait. Yeah.
Yeah. And now you can't open the door. And then now it's just that you take the shot.
Yeah.
Half the time, yeah, that's a cool picture.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it and then you never see it. Look
it's
at
true.
It again.
It's true. I have so many. I'm actually running out of space on my phone right now because I have so many photos in there and I'm afraid to delete them because I'm going to need them someday. I'm like a hoarder. I'm a photo hoarder. And they're all in there. And it's,
you need the cloud.
I probably. Yeah. See, I hear all those things. It's too fancy. I'm not technological.
It's really not.
Yeah, I know. You know, I do. Well, I don't have an iPhone, isn't
it? It's not really a cloud. It's just remote storage that it's okay.
So see, now you're already talking above my head. I have no idea. You know, but I do know that I used to like love to take photos when I was a kid. I had a Fisher Price camera as a little kid and I just would love it. I mean, it was fun. But like you said, you know, I would take the photo, but you didn't know how it turned out. You didn't have a preview of it. You never, you had to wait to take it over to like a CVS or a whatever and wait like a week to get those photos back.
Yeah.
And then they were always overexposed or they looked like crap. But you know, you took them and you hope for the best. Sometimes you come out with a good photo. Now you can take a billion to come out with whatever you want.
Yeah, I think in a way, it isn't as special in a way.
No.
Because you can take a picture of everything.
It's true. It's true. Not like these days where, you know, they, like you said, you had to work to take a photo. You had to make it and set it and do it. And like these iconic images I'm talking about that our guest today took, they are art. I mean, this is art now. You know, this isn't just like, oh, look, I took my selfie today and I used all my filters and, oh, look, I don't even look like me anymore. You know, these are real. This is art. And it's kind of, you know, cool. You can't even compare the two things anymore, I don't think.
No. And I know that they come out with these NFTs, which are supposed to be
kind of
like.
Oh, now you're
like,
going way off into.
But it's like with your guest, he has the original.
Yeah, he has the original.
Now you could take a picture, put it online, and essentially that's almost like the original because you're just putting the same image online, and that means everybody could have the same thing.
Yeah, it's diluting again. Everything we're creating technology to make it better, supposedly, but in a lot of different ways, music included. When I do a lot of musicians, you're kind of diluting some of the stuff that made whatever it is really good once upon a time. I sound like an old person, like, get off my lawn. But seriously, you're really music with AI and all these things you can create now in a studio. And it's just, you're kind of dumbing it down. You're creating cool stuff still, but
on the flip side, with our phones now, you will be able to capture moments that you might not have been able to if you didn't have like your disposable camera in your pocket.
It's true.
You might be like, oh my God, I missed that. I'm never going to see that again.
It's true. But brings up a good point. Are we living in the moment, though, too? Are we paying attention to what's going on? Or are we at a concert and we're not paying attention to the music? We're taking a video. We're shooting something. We're live streaming. We're doing all these things.
That's what everything is these days. The
it
moment.
Is. I
Social
don't...
media is, Twitter especially.
But we're
That's
not
all
present.
Instant.
But we're not present. Like, I know that when I'm worried about my phone, I'm not actually 100% engaged in what I'm doing because I'm worried, how's that shot coming out? Am I in the right focus? Am I in this angle?
Yeah.
And I really think I've tried recently to do this a lot more, is to put my phone away. And if I don't have a memory of it, it's okay. I have a better memory of it in my head. And I think that's actually what's more important. You're being in
and
your head and your heart.
Sometimes it feels good to know that if you consciously put your phone away and know you're not going to touch it, then it kind of feels good to know that, okay, I haven't touched social media or anything in like an hour. That was a great hour.
Do it. And it is good to kind of cleanse. I mean, that's a whole nother issue. Sometimes you need that little bit of a hiatus from all that crap because you can go mad if you see it all the time. But I don't want them to put it away right now, though, because we've got a great show. So they need to get their phones, their everything out right now to listen to this amazing show with our guest today.
All right, let's go.
Bob Gruen is one of the most well-known and respected photographers in the world of rock and roll. For over 50 years, he has captured the music scene in photographs that have gained worldwide recognition. As chief photographer for Rock Scene magazine in the 70s, Bob specialized in candid, behind-the-scenes photo features. He toured extensively with the emerging punk and new wave bands, including the Sex Pistols, Clash, Ramones, and Blondie. Bob has also worked with major rock acts like Led Zeppelin, The Who, David Bowie, Tina Turner, Elton John, Aerosmith, Kiss, and of course, Alice Cooper. In 1989, he even documented the epic journey to Russia of the Moscow Peace Music Peace Festival, which featured Motley Crue and Bon Jovi. But his greatest work was perhaps becoming John Lennon and Yoko Ono's personal photographer and friend in 1971, making photos of their working life as well as private moments. Bob Gruen's work has been featured in collections around the world. He has had a documentary about his work called Rock and Roll Exposed, The Photography of Bob Gruen, and recently released his memoir, Right Place, Right Time, The Life of a Rock and Roll Photographer. Here to discuss his process, career, and some of the iconic legends he has worked with is the man himself, multi-award-winning photographer and author, Bob Gruen. Hi, Bob. What's going on?
Hi. Well, thanks a lot. I'm sitting here in my studio in New York and ready to talk to you.
I love it. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing a lot of your work. I assume that's all your work behind you?
Yeah, it's kind of my inspiration wall. Things keep me company.
I love that. I love it. Now, do you feel like you're ever in there and all of a sudden something just like sparks that inspiration for you?
Well, these are all memories I have. I remember being in all these places. I remember what they sound like. And most of them that I put up on the wall here are my friends.
Oh, well, they're all kind of your friends.
It's kind of like
Snap. Yeah. You do. You kind of have made these friendships with these artists. It's not that you just shoot them and you run away and you never talk to them again. You've had relationships that you have cultivated over these years and worked with them many, many times.
Well, it doesn't always happen. I mean, sometimes it's a 10-20 minute photo session, but a lot of people I have gotten friends with. But going back to high school, I was always friends with the artistic people, the people in the theater group, the folk music group, the art groups and stuff like that. I just tend to live an artist's lifestyle and get along with artist people. And a lot of the people I've met, I do make friends with, certainly with John Lennon, Joe Strummer, lots of people.
Oh, you have an incredible body of work and the people, the legends. I don't usually throw that word around a lot, but in your case, you have lived with legends over the years. And it's got to be pretty a pinch me moments to be with these people. I know they're just real people like everybody else, but they're still iconic.
Yeah, there's some pretty charismatic people I've gotten to know.
Yes, I can imagine. And we're going to talk about probably some of these behind the scenes stories because you've seen things that most people would never get to see. But before we get there, I want to say you're a New Yorker through and through, born and raised in New York.
Right.
And early on, you decided to drop out of college and quit your job working in a photo booth at the New York World's Fair in Brooklyn, and the rest is history.
Well, the World's Fair was in Queens, but I was selling film and flashbulbs, and I had to take off and go to the Newport Folk Festival. And luckily, I got fired just before the festival started, so I actually got a severance pay to pay for the gas and stuff. But that was 1965. I went up to Newport. I saw the Bob Dylan when he came out and played electric. It was the first time I ever had a photo pass, and I got to have pictures of that. It was kind of a seminal moment because, you know, when Bob Dylan came out at the folk music and he was playing with a rock and roll band, a lot of people were upset. They were booing, they were cheering, they were fighting with each other. But I think that Bob Dylan was making a statement that rock and roll is the folk music of America.
Mm.
And that's certainly true because rock and roll is spread from America around the world.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And I've also read that you credit Ike Turner with the start of your career almost.
Yes, actually, a friend of mine, this really, because I was taking pictures since I learned photography from my mother when I was and when I was 8 years old. They gave me my first camera. I started taking pictures of the family and friends and things. But when I was 19, my early 20s, a friend of mine said, we had to go see Tina Turner because she was amazing. And we went to see a show, and Tina was more than amazing. She was the most amazing person I've ever seen on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And back a couple of days later, they were playing a club in Queens called the Honka Monka Room, of all places. And I brought my cameras. The first time I brought my camera to take pictures of somebody that wasn't a friend of mine. I was living with a rock and roll band at that point called the Glitter House. So I took my picture. I took the camera with me, and I took some pictures of Tina and Ike that night. I got some really good pictures. And at the end of her set, she dances off to a strobe light. And I just took a chance, and I opened the camera to 1 second to see if I could capture several of the strobe effects. And 3 or 4 of the pictures are useless, but one of them is the most perfect picture I've ever taken. And it captured 5 images of Tina Turner in her dance, in her movement. And it just captures the excitement and the energy that is Tina. And so I went to see that they played a few shows around New York that week, luckily for me, because we went to see another one at a theater in the Round, and the dressing rooms were outside. So as we were walking, I brought the pictures with me to show to my friends that were coming with us. And as we were walking out, one of my friends saw Ike Turner going from one dressing room to another and kind of pushed me in front of Ike and said, show Ike the pictures. And he stopped and he said, what pictures? And I showed him and he said, oh, these pictures are pretty good. I got to show these to Tina. And he took me in the dressing room. Mm. And all of a sudden, Tina Turner was looking at my pictures and she was liking them. And I was having trouble breathing. And Ike said, come meet me in New York on Monday. I'll introduce you to this publicist. And he introduced me to the publicist, who introduced me to another publicist. And that guy got me hired for Elton John's first time in New York. And Elton liked me, and he hired me a couple more times. And that same publicist also introduced me to Alice Cooper. And I started working with Alice for years and years. I worked with Alice. So that night with Tina Turner really kind of kicked everything off for me. And it just started snowballing after that. And within a couple of years, 2 years later, I met John and Yoko.
Wow. Yeah, your career did take a meteoric rise very quickly. I mean, from taking that leap of faith to just kind of being in the right place at the right time, kind of what your memoir was sort of saying, that, you know, things sort of like serendipitous almost, these things that just sort of happened.
Well, it just leads to another. And I just end up in the right place at the right time. But then you have to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And you make things work for you and try to add something to the situation so that people want you to come back.
Mm.
And that's one reason I try to get to be friends with people, because I want them to hire me again, you know.
You know, I agree with you. I have a professor back in music school back many, many moons ago from myself. He said that it's very easy to get hired. It's very, very difficult to get rehired.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to do a good job the first time.
Exactly. You can always get that first time, but then, you know, you got to do a good job. Yep.
Exactly. I mean, you do get a lucky break, but then you have to give people something that they're going to want again.
Yeah.
And really, I was able to take a lot of good pictures of a lot of people over and over again. And also the personality, like I get along with people, so they didn't mind having me around. You know, for a lot of people, they'd rather go to a dentist than have their picture taken, you know. So I try to be quick and painless.
I like that. You know, you're right. There are some, there are certain personalities, and in artists, there are very big personalities. And I'm sure you've kind of experienced all of that. I know John Lennon was very easy to photograph for you because he was used to being in front of a camera. But then there's probably others that are so reserved that you were like trying to get them to come out of like 20 shells. And maybe you could get something, you know, finally after working with them.
Yeah, I mean, certain people, you know, they get so nervous about taking a picture, they freeze up and then they don't get a good picture. And so they hate having the picture taken because they always freeze up and they always get a bad picture. But I try to relax people and just get into conversation with people. And that seems to work for me.
Mm-hmm. I would say so because of your body of work. I think it's worked for you. I do want to say, though, that you mentioned your mom, and I do want to give, you know, shout out to your mom, that she was your biggest inspiration. I've read that you've said that, and that your first, I think you were 8 when you got your first camera, and it was a Brownie Hawkeye camera, correct?
Right. Yes. My mom was an attorney, but her hobby was photography. She liked to develop and print her own pictures. So when I was too big to go to sleep early, but too little to leave running around the house on my own, she took me in the dark from like 4 or 5 years old. And I was just fascinated with the way a picture just appears on a piece of paper. And so, yeah, when I was 8 years old, it was the only present. I got a present every year, but the only one I actually remember opening was my first camera. And I was just so excited about it. And I just started taking pictures right away. And it's kind of worked out for me over the years.
Yeah. Now, what do you use now? I know I read a more recent interview. You use a Canon EOS 5D Mark III. Is that still your go-to, or do you have?
Yes. Yeah. That's my main working camera. I only take that out when I'm being paid for a job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You got to bring the big guns out. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, I've always carried a camera with me ever since I got the Brownie Hawk. I remember actually giving a speech. We had a speech class. I had to give a speech, and my speech was about carrying a camera wherever you go, so you're always ready. So I've been doing that. And then as cameras got smaller and smaller, I was able to not carry my whole camera bag, but I could carry a pocket camera when they made little digital cameras. But actually, just a few years ago, the iPhone got so good that I don't even carry the pocket camera. I just use the iPhone all the time.
Really?
It gets amazing. But when I get hired for a job, I bring out the Canon, you know?
Yeah, but what a good endorsement for an iPhone. I got to say, we got to get royalties here because that is a huge endorsement to say that that iPhone camera is good enough for Bob Gruen. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, they don't pay me anything, but it's just that the thing works so well. I'm just amazed at the modern technology.
Oh, it's true. It's true. I have a Samsung Galaxy, and I got to say, that is a really good camera as well. I got to say, it rivals it.
Cameras, they work in the dark. I mean, you know, with film, it was very difficult to shoot in the dark places where I was when I was in a recording studio. A lot of musicians like the light to be like as low as like candlelight or something, and film doesn't really like to pick that up. So it was very difficult getting good shots in the dark places that I was, but the iPhone just invents light or something. I don't know.
AI, who knows? Nowadays with everything.
Well, maybe they're making it up, but it looks like what I was looking at. You know,
you know, you kind of, it touches on another point, because I was thinking about, in my experience, a lot of photographers I've worked with, they can either do really well in like a session shoot, or they do really well live with like the actual dark lighting and the movement, but a lot of them can't do both. And you do. You're very, very, very good with capturing something on stage like Prince and those many, many shots you got of him. And then, there, you know, the very intimate, like with Debbie Harry and John Lennon, just sitting there, you know, at their home. And you were able to do both really well.
Well, I always like to come back with a good picture. And I like a challenge. You know, I like the variety of different kinds of things, you know, taking pictures of a person in a living room or in a stage or in a backstage with 20 other people around. Every job for me is a challenge. And when I accomplish that challenge, I always feel really good that I got something good done.
Mm-hmm. And we're having something good here today on the show because you're listening to The Scene with Doreen, and I'm having a great time with iconic rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen. When we come back, we're going to talk about one of his favorite subjects to ever set foot in front of his camera. We'll be right back after this.
Choosing the right insurance company can be complex and confusing. At Leonard O'Neill Insurance Group, we don't just sell you an insurance policy. We sell you a lifetime of peace of mind, service, and satisfaction. A second generation, family-owned and operated business in South Jersey, we're committed to protecting you and your family. With over 2,000 clients in the tri-state area, we are your local trusted insurance experts specializing in business, life and health, and personal insurance. Contact Leonard O'Neill Insurance Group today to learn how we can get started on your insurance journey together. Visit www.log-insurance.com or call 856-627-2600.
Oh, yes. Welcome back to The Scene with Doreen. I'm your host, Doreen Taylor, and I'm chatting with award-winning rock and roll photographer and author Bob Gruen. Bob, you've worked with so many incredible legends throughout your career, but I have to bring up the incredibly beautiful Debbie Harry. I recently had Chris Stein of Blondie on the show, and I know that he took a lot of Blondie's photos, but so did you. And your first exposure to Debbie was when she was just starting out. You saw her when she was with the Stilettos, right?
Right. I remember Lisa Robinson, who was a major journalist here in America. I did a lot of work with Lisa Robinson. And she called me up one day and she said, go to this club, I think with Brownies or someplace, maybe Mother's, to see the Stilettos. And she said, they have a lead singer, Debbie Harry. She's very beautiful. She's going to be really big. And I remember walking in a room and seeing Debbie and going, yes, she's really beautiful.
Oh, yes. A photographer's dream, like you've said.
Yeah, you can't take a bad picture of Debbie because she's just the most beautiful person there is. And luckily, we hit it off and got to be friends, and Chris and I are friends. And so I got to spend a lot of time with them in the early days, pictures of them at Max's Kansas City or CBGB's. I actually saw them in England, I think in France, a couple of places I caught up with them. Debbie is the nicest, punkiest New Jersey girl you'll ever want to meet. She's really smart and really... sophisticated in a way, but also very punky. And you know, she comes up with the sarcastic answers that just keep everybody laughing. So it's always fun to be with Debbie.
I think you need that in that industry. I think if you lose that sense of just having those quick quips coming back in people and just being able to kind of keep them on their toes, you kind of lose something in the game. I think it's amazing. That's probably why she's lasted. I mean, come on, how many years? And still, didn't I just see her? I thought I just saw her somewhere on a social media campaign. Gucci. Yes, Gucci.
Back a limo or something, a Gucci ad. Debbie is actually older than me. I'm one of the oldest people around here. I'm 79, and Debbie's 4 months older than me.
Ooh, is she going to be happy you're saying this out there?
I don't know. I think so. She's proud to be, you know, to have survived and to still be playing on stage. I mean, she was just on, you know, tour a couple months ago.
Yeah, it's amazing. She's still doing it. And, you know, it's kind of a testament to doing what you love. You don't work a day in your life, kind of like what you do. It's not really work when you love what you do. It is work, but you enjoy it at least.
I read something that Fran Lebowitz wrote one time when she had that writer's block, and she figured out that she used to love writing, and you know, when she was growing up, and then all of a sudden she just couldn't do it anymore. And the difference she found out was that she loved doing it, but she didn't like working. Mm. You know, it's one thing to just have fun and do what you love, but when you're actually, you got to run and you got to be there on time and you got to get it done on time, you got to get something out, that's work. But yes, it's a lot more fun to be doing something you like and something you enjoy. Because certainly when I got a good picture, when I got an assignment done and people said, I really like it, I feel a tremendous sense of accomplishment. And, you know, I feel like I've done something good. It's not just like stamping papers all day or stapling something and filing something. I actually create something that people like. That's tremendously rewarding for me.
Well, think about it. You create things that will stand the test of time. I mean, you're creating something that, like, I can't imagine there are very many people out there that have never seen the John Lennon New York City t-shirt on top of, you know, his penthouse. I mean, everyone has seen that. Whether they know they have, they've seen it.
That one tends to get around a lot.
Yes, it does. Another one, though. Go ahead.
The picture of John Lennon. The picture of John Lennon at the Statue of Liberty, which I feel is one of my most important pictures. The one I posted today is actually 50 years since I went to the Statue of Liberty with John Lennon.
Wow.
And I just feel that picture is really important because it stands for personal freedom. Mm. And for me, you see, rock and roll is all about freedom. It's about the freedom to express your feelings very loudly in public. Mm. It's about that moment when everybody's screaming yay and nobody's thinking about paying the rent.
Mm.
You know? Free and open and just happy to be.
Yeah.
And I try to capture those moments in my pictures so that I'm not just capturing facts of what color shirt some guy was wearing, but capturing the feelings and the excitement of the moment.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I start. I capture it and people tell me that they like the picture. Like I say, that's a great accomplishment for me.
Oh, yes. And I also have to mention, since we are talking about Debbie Harry, a lot of people think that your shot with Debbie and Iggy Pop is maybe perhaps your best shot ever. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't know if it's the best shot. It's the best two people together probably ever.
Yeah, and I think...
And it was so...
Yeah.
mean, that was not a photo session. I went to Toronto because in those days when I was following a band and I was working for Rock Scene magazine and Cream magazine, and I thought a couple of magazines would be buying the photos, I could spend my own money to take a plane up to, I think it was in Toronto, where Iggy was opening, and he had Blondie as the opening act. And Blondie's actually said that that's what spread them across America. That's what opened them up to the world when Iggy took them on tour. Mm-hmm. And just before the first show, Iggy was in the dressing room saying hello to Debbie. And I said, can I get a picture of the two of you? And we literally stepped to the side of the dressing room into the bathroom. If you look at that picture, the background is all tiles. It's a bathroom.
Yes.
And instead of just standing there like next to each other, Iggy put his arm around Debbie. And then much to my surprise, he reached down and grabbed her breast. And I thought, wow, why didn't I think of that? You
know? Oh, he liked her. All the rumors that I've heard. Oh, he liked her a lot.
Debbie said that Iggy, in my documentary, actually, Iggy says that Debbie was the waitress that you always wanted to get but couldn't.
Oh, see, I think a lot of people probably felt that about her, that that was the one.
Get in line. Debbie is the most attractive person I've ever met.
Oh, she is. She's gorgeous. She really is.
But she had a really good relationship, very strong relationship with Chris, and that kind of kept her protected because they were always together on tour for all those years.
Yes. Very special relationship they had over those years. And it's hard to, you know, in that world to maintain something like that for so long. You know, people go in and out of relationships. That was a really long term relationship for that industry.
Oh, absolutely. Many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're still working together. They're still probably like brother and sister, kind of close to each other, even though they live separate. And Chris went and got married and had kids with someone, with Barbara, you know, with someone else. But
they'll always have that bond.
They'll always have that bond, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. My ex-wife married me and my current wife. She performed the ceremony. You know, sometimes.
Wow,
she just
that is really nice. I see. That's a nice thing to hear.
Well, it depends on the reasons why you broke up. My ex-wife and I broke up because we liked each other. We knew we were going to do different things and live in different places. Yeah. But we never separated in the sense of our friendship and our caring and our love for each other. Mm. We've done together.
Yeah. Yeah, very smart. You're listening to The Scene with Doreen, and I'm having a blast talking with the award-winning rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen. When we come back, we're going to talk about his special and very unique relationship with one of the biggest musicians to ever walk on this planet. You don't want to miss this. We'll be right back. Hey guys, are you loving the show? Do you want to see more of The Scene? Well, guess what? You can, because The Scene with Doreen is now a weekly segment on the nationally syndicated television show, The Daily Flash. The Daily Flash is your daily destination for trending stories, celebrity updates, and industry highlights. And it's now your home to watch The Scene with Doreen. You can turn us on and watch every Wednesday across the country. Check your local times and listings at thescenewithdoreen.com. Oh, welcome back to The Scene with Doreen, and I am your tour guide for today, Doreen Taylor, and I'm chatting with legendary pop culture rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen. It seemed fitting to play, coming out of this break, it was Ringo Starr's song, Photograph, because it's a big anniversary for you. 50 years ago, 1974, you created one of the most iconic rock and roll images of all time, the great John Lennon in the New York City t-shirt on the roof of his East 52nd Street penthouse. We talked a little bit about it, but I would love to dive in a little more.
Well, the New York City picture I took actually on August 30th. And what it was John had called me to come to his apartment. He was still separated from Yoko for a while. And he had an apartment on the east side with a penthouse apartment. It had a little roof outside. And he asked me to come over to take some pictures of his face for the album cover for Walls and Bridges, because the art director had a whole series where he was just going to have John's face close up. And then they were going to have strips of that photograph that you fold over from the back to make different eyes and different mouths and different expressions. And it became kind of a toy. Mm. And we just needed like dozens of pictures straight on of his face, the same size. And so I set up a tripod and a background on I put some paper up on a wall. And we shot off a series of pictures like that. And then John said, well, let's take some more pictures so we have everything ready for the publicity kit. So we started taking some pictures around the roof, and the skyline of New York was all around us. And I thought, do you still see, in 1973, a year earlier, I had given John the New York City T-shirt because it was something that I saw guys in Times Square. It wasn't even from a store or a company. It was just some guys that made this shirt and they sold it on a blanket in Times Square. Mm-hmm. And I bought one and I liked it a lot. I liked the strong graphics of the way it looked. And, you know, it's very, very simple, but very strong. Here's a coffee cup with the logo on it.
Yeah.
It's spread around since the picture got so popular. But anyway, one night I was on my way to the studio to see Sean at the record plant, and the guys were on the sidewalk. So I bought a shirt for him, and I cut the sleeves off with my buck knife to give it more of a New York kind of tough guy look. And I gave it to him that night, and it was a year later we were on the roof. And he had been to L.A. and back. I might have heard about the Lost Weekend. This was kind of towards the end of that. And anyway, with the skylight around us on the roof, I asked him if he still had the shirt. And he knew right where it was, and he went and put it on. So I knew he liked it because he had kept it with him.
Yeah.
And he just looked great. And we were having a conversation. So in the photo, he looks very available because we are in the middle of a conversation. And he just looks healthy and confident. And we had no idea that picture was going to become as popular as it has. It was just meant to be another publicity picture, one of many, many, many pictures that John had done. But for some reason, people really liked that picture. It really kind of took off. And the fact that, you know, I like the fact that it says New York City because I felt that John was really getting comfortable in New York City. He liked being here. He liked the art scene in New York. He was getting to be friends with a lot of Yoko's art friends. And he enjoyed being able to walk around. You know, in New York, you can be kind of anonymous on the streets mm-hmm. where, you know, you might see somebody famous somewhere. I mean, often if you see somebody who looks like Robert Redford in Des Moines, it's probably somebody who looks like Robert Redford. But if you see somebody like that in New York, it's probably really Robert Redford. But you're not going to let him take your taxi. You know what I mean? You're busy too. So John could walk around pretty anonymously in a sense that people would see him, but they wouldn't bother him.
Yeah.
So he really seemed to be liking New York. So I like the fact that he's wearing the New York shirt and kind of proud to be here.
Yeah. Now, you said that you never imagined that it would become as big of pop culture history that it has. Why, in your experience, though, you've taken so many amazing photos, iconic photos. Why do you think that one really did resonate so strongly with people?
Well, I think he looks very comfortable, very confident, and very available. Like I said, we're in the middle of a conversation, so he looks like he's available to talk to you, too. And if you look closely at the picture, it was a decent print, you can actually see his eyes through the sunglasses. So he looks like he's looking right at you and talking to you. He's actually talking to me, but he looks at the picture, feels like he's talking to them. Mm. And somebody used the word, they said it's self-revelatory because it says New York and it looks like New York. You know, it's got the whole skyline there.
Yeah.
And I can't explain why, because there are so many pictures. When I met John, he'd already been a Beatle and he had tens of thousands of photos taken, probably right. Millions of photos taken of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very comfortable having his picture taken. And we were just in the middle of a conversation. Like I say, that was just one of a number of pictures we did around the roof after we did the album cover picture. But that's the one that really took off.
Yeah. Now, do you have any recollection what you guys were talking about? Do you remember?
No.
No? No? I was like, oh, you could make it up. You could totally make a great story there.
You know, we're having a chat. I mean, we talk about most people, like, you know, the time of day, what's happening.
Or, right. The weather.
The weather. Yeah. I mean, we didn't really discuss politics or peace, you know, like that. I mean, that was a public thing that he did.
Right.
But, yeah, we talk about, you know, what are you having for dinner? You know?
I love it. No, I mean, that's what, you know, it's so great that you're here to remind us that these are real people. They may have these incredible jobs and incredible exposure to the world, but they are deep down, though, they're still just like you and me. They just have these really neat jobs.
Well, as Bob Dylan said, even the president of the United States must sometimes have to stand naked.
Yeah.
You know, we're all just naked apes somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting way to put it. You're absolutely right about it. You know, I think people don't realize, too, you did become the personal photographer for many years in the 70s leading up to John's tragic death. But you weren't just the photographer. You became their friend.
I mean, I can't explain how you become friends with somebody and why John and Yoko were friends with me. But lots of people got my phone number, called me up. Joe Stromer used to come to town and call me up. After John died, Yoko and I became very close. That I would, you know, go and see her at night. We'd talk for hours about all kinds of things going on. And I can't explain why. We just like each other, you know, we get along.
Yeah. Yeah. You never know why.
Become,
yeah.
you meet them and you share the same kind of sense of humor and, you know, same taste and stuff. I have a real affinity for Japan. Yoko took me to Japan during that separation period. Yoko went to Japan because they were being sued by Alan Klein when they were dissolving the Beatles. All of their money was being held in escrow. People don't know that. You know, they couldn't touch any of the money that they had until everything was decided about who was going to get what percentage.
Right.
So Yoko actually booked a tour in Japan and did 10 dates over there just to raise some money to, you know, pay expenses, daily expenses.
Again, they're just like us. They're just like us, you know.
But very lucky for me, she took me there and I met a lot of people in Japan. And I established the whole career. I've been to Japan about 14, 16 times. My autobiography actually came out in a Japanese translation about last month. It just came out. And I made lots of friends. And in fact, after going back, after with Yoko, then I went back to New York Dolls and Bay City Rollers. I went twice with Kiss. And then I got my own apartment in Harajuku in Tokyo because I was so fascinated each time I went with a band. But you're so busy when you go with a band. They have every minute on a schedule. And everything just looked fascinating. So I came back and got an apartment and stayed there for months and just really got into the Japanese culture, made friends there. It was an amazing place, thanks to Yoko.
Oh, definitely. Do you believe
and that?
That
was something that I shared with John as well, because he really appreciated going to Japan with Yoko and getting into Japanese food. And we both shared that, you know, a liking for Japanese food.
Now, do you feel Japan inspired you in your photography as well, just spending that time there? Do you think it influenced any of your art going forward?
I don't know if it influenced me or if I was already influenced by that. One of the first photographers I ever worked for as an assistant, actually, was a Japanese-American from Hawaii. So I've always kind of felt comfortable with Japanese things.
Yeah. Now, I do want to bring up, I just had the wonderful Kate Pearson of the B-52s on the show, and we talked about their tune, Rock Lobster, and how that inspired Lennon to get back in the studio to record what would be his final album, Double Fantasy. And I know that you spent a lot of time in 1980 at the Hit Factory taking photos while he was making that album.
Right. Actually, the B-52s were getting talked about in New York. They played at the Mud Club, I think, and the Seabees, and I heard about them, but I'd never seen them. I actually met the B-52s in Japan.
Really? Japan again?
Spent some time with them. I went to Kyoto with them for a day. That's how I got to know Kate. She lives up in Woodstock. She's fantastic. One of the hippest people I know.
Love her. Yes.
And yes, the story that I heard, John went to Bermuda on a vacation with Sean. And one night he went into a disco to see what was going on. And he heard the Rock Lobster. And B-52s are actually big fans of Yoko. And they actually were copying her style of that, the kind of high-pitched rhythmic sound that Yoko makes with her voice. And they copied that in Rock Lobster. And when John heard that, he thought, oh, my God, maybe the world's finally ready to hear Yoko make that sound again.
Mm-hmm.
The Birds did it in the 60s. They hated it, and they had no idea what it was. But it seemed that the world was ready. And actually, in 1980, when they were recording, when the Double Fantasy album first came out, the last conversation I had with John Lennon, he was very happy that the record was going up the charts and it was getting great reviews. And what he was most happy about was that Yoko was finally getting good reviews and that they were calling her music avant-garde and very interesting. Mm. And in fact, they were in the studio recording a new single, the Walking on Thin Ice single, to capitalize on the fact that Yoko was finally getting some good press. And he said, John said, they're calling my music MOR, which means middle of the road. And he said, that's okay. I'm going down the middle of the road to the bank.
Yeah, you know what? Sometimes that pays the bills. Middle of the road is not
Absolutely.
Always.
He had to do.
You know, you got to see John in a way that most people never will ever, and especially, you know, they never had that chance to experience him that way. As we approach the 45th anniversary of his tragic death next year, what's the most important takeaway from your time with him that is forever ingrained in your heart?
Oh, well, what people missed, because towards the end, after John spent 5 years raising Sean out of the public light, he had a lot of time to think about life and get his thoughts together. And towards the end, he was very, very, very serious about controlling addictions, and alcohol and drugs were behind him. He was very concerned about a diet. He was actually living a macrobiotic diet, which is a great diet with a bad name. It's basically vegetables and rice and a healthy, balanced diet. He was very involved with, you know, living a much healthier life. And I think that he would have been an inspiration for that for people around the world. And it's a shame that they didn't get to hear all of that.
Yeah.
On John and Yoko, at one point in the 70s, mid-70s, they got a flu and they came down and was sick for a couple of days. And when they got better, instead of just going back to their normal routine, they tried Dick Gregory's advice and they went on a fruit diet where you just eat things that go through the juicer. It's like a liquid diet and mostly fruit juice. And they did that for 40 days. Mm. And I went there in the middle of it. John was like kind of spaced out, and he said he was like everything was tingling, and he was aware of everything so much more. He felt so clean and healthy. Mm. And when they came out, and in order to do the diet, in order to stay not eating for 40 days, John's a very smart person because all he was thinking about was food. He started reading books about food. He started reading cookbooks, and he would read a whole elaborate recipe and then turn the page. And he was thinking about food, but not having to actually eat. Hmm. And so he was having all these food fantasies, but not having to go to the kitchen. And he read about food history. And then he met Gloria Swanson, whose husband wrote a book about macrobiotics called You Are All Sam Paku. And he read that book, and it really affected him in the sense of he really understood that eating a healthier diet makes for a healthier person. And he actually bought a case of those books, and he gave one to all of his friends, and I got one. And I remember at the time I was more on the cognac and steak diet. But after he passed and I started thinking about the relationship, I got that book out, and I read it, and I spent a year or two myself on a macro diet. It's very hard to keep a strict macro diet going in a world that is full of butter and grease and everything else.
Yeah.
A lot of meat around. But as much as you can, it's a very helpful and very healthy diet.
Mm.
Just kind of eat more vegetables and grains. And I think that John would have been a spokesman for that and helped a lot of people out.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's left so many gifts on this planet, and his legacy will never go away. And you helped also propel that because of the amazing photos that you took with him. And it's a legacy that will never probably be replicated, in my opinion.
Well, and the thing is, when we did the pictures on the roof, it was in August. But then thinking about it a couple of weeks later, I think it was probably around his birthday in October when I came up with the idea. Because the United States government, the Richard Nixon administration, was trying to deport John Lennon. And I felt that artists like John Lennon should be welcome to America, and that a symbol of welcome is the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested to John that we go to the Statue of Liberty and take a picture of him there to dramatize his case that here we are, a country that should be welcoming people, and they were trying to throw John out.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately thought that it was a great idea. And doing it was actually very simple. And it was really 50 years ago today, October 30th, 1974. We went down there like two normal people. I picked him up. We drove down to the Battery Park. I remember we got out, and there's all these buildings of Wall Street down there. And John looked at all the big buildings, and he said, I better have a lawyer in every one of these buildings. I'm paying rent everywhere. Because <You know? laughs> when you have that much money, you get involved in a lot of lawsuits.
Oh, I know. They come for you.
Ferry. We just bought tickets like a normal tourist from England, and went out to the island on the ferry, walked around to the front. I only took about a half a roll of pictures because there was just one pose I was looking for. We weren't looking for too many others, and he just kind of stood there and gave a peace sign, and we were done. And we came back, and the thing was, he wanted to get it done earlier in the afternoon because he was still recording the Walls and Bridges album, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty simple to do it, but it became a very important picture, I think, because like I said, John and the statue both, you know, stand for personal freedom for a lot of people.
Oh, amen to that. You're listening to The Scene with Doreen, and I have been talking all hour with award-winning rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen. When we come back, we're going to talk about the future of the music scene and what Bob has in store for us next. We'll be right back to wrap this all up. Stay tuned.
Choosing the right insurance company can be complex and confusing. At Leonard O'Neill Insurance Group, we don't just sell you an insurance policy, we sell you a lifetime of peace of mind, service, and satisfaction. A second-generation, family-owned and operated business in South Jersey, we're committed to protecting you and your family. With over 2,000 clients in the tri-state area, we are your local, trusted insurance experts specializing in business, life and health, and personal insurance. Contact Leonard O'Neill Insurance Group today to learn how we can get started on your insurance journey together. Visit www.log-insurance.com or call 856-627-2600.
Somebody who makes
makes me laugh. Every time I do, it makes me.
Welcome back to The Scene with Doreen. I'm Doreen Taylor, and I've been chatting with legendary pop culture rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen. A lot of people say that the punk scene died in the 80s, but you are still working with Green Day, and I can't imagine a better modern reincarnation of the punk genre, can you?
Well, they do it really well. I mean, they're lively, they're definitely, you know, got a great beat that you can dance to, and they've got good meaning to their songs. And they just, you know, such a punky attitude. I remember they didn't, you know, they have words that are common curse words on some of their records. And they were doing an interview and somebody said, well, Walmart, which sells half of the records in America, people don't sell records anymore, but this is back when people sold records.
Yes, yeah.
And he said, they sold half of the records in America, but they wouldn't carry a record that had what they called, you know, foul language or, you know, dirty words. And they had Billy, you know, they wouldn't change their album. A lot of artists put out a G-rated album so that they can sell records in Walmart. And they changed the lyrics to cut out the dirty words. And they asked Billy Joel why Green Day wouldn't change the lyrics and do it that way. And he said, well, this is the way we write it, and this is the way we talk. And he said, if Walmart thinks that our music is dangerous, why don't they move it to the other side of the store and sell it next to the guns and knives that they sell? You know, it's a nice attitude to talk about it. A word is dangerous, but an AK-47 is not. I mean, right. Come on. What are you going to sell? You
know? Right. Well,
Green Day is one of my favorite bands nowadays. But I was actually out at Eugene Lutz from the Go-Go Adela organized a night with a couple of punk bands out in Brooklyn the other night. And I went there and it reminded me of being in CBGB's with these young kids playing their heart out. They were great. They were tight. There was three different bands. The place was full of kids who were dancing, which made me really happy that kids in Brooklyn actually would go out to a club and meet each other and dance and have fun. Just sitting at home on a computer like you imagine they would be. So I think the scene is very much alive and well. There's clubs all over Brooklyn with kids playing, you know, music all over America, all over the world. Kids playing rock and roll because it sets you free. Rock and roll sets you free, and that's what people like about it.
Yeah.
And now it's got such a big definition. There's emo and there's this kind and there's hardcore and there's a million kinds of rock and roll. But basically, it's music that sets you free. And that's what rock and roll is.
Freedom. You're right. My producer and I were just talking about before the show started about all the subgenres and all the different, you know, I have someone coming on the show later that is shock rock, something I never knew existed. Or, you know, there's art rock. And then I always thought was progressive rock, you know?
Yeah. There's all kinds of different kinds, you know. But it's all rock and roll and it's all for having a good time.
Right. Wasn't it Billy Joel? It's all rock and roll to me.
That's right. That's the way it is.
Now, you have been a part of the tapestry of the music industry for half a century. I mean, that's crazy to think about, probably.
It is. Never expected that.
But with the rapidly... Go ahead. Sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you. Yeah, please. I would love to hear your reflections of 50 years.
In the 60s, you know, you're under a lot of pressure to get a job. And Timothy Leary was saying, turn on, tune in, and drop out. And I didn't really want a job in an establishment that was fighting what I felt was an unjust war in Vietnam. And I just didn't want a 9 to 5. I can't really do the 9 o'clock part.
Yeah.
I'm better at 5 to 9 of working overnight.
Right.
I kind of dropped out to live with a rock and roll band, but I didn't know I was actually just falling into a career for the rest of my life. You know?
It's funny how certain things, you know, you would never know. Then they lead you to the next amazing chapter of your life and you would never expect it.
Exactly. But like, if you read my book, one thing just led to another. It was a whole serendipitous flow. I'd run into people and that would take me to the next place.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to say, though, you have been part of this for 50 years and you've seen all these different trends. And with the ever changing pop culture trends of today, which I think they change every 5 minutes now, do you think we're ever going to see the legends like Zeppelin, Debbie Harry or John Lennon ever again?
Well, it's a different kind of world and different people. I would think that every generation has somebody that stands out. But now the internet, you know, which was supposed to make everybody equal and connect everybody, really diversifies everything so that there's no, you know, it used to be a much more limited thing. Television was nationwide, but there were only 3 channels that went nationwide. And so most people saw the same thing. Sunday nights, everybody saw Ed Sullivan. Now on Sunday nights, everybody's watching a different channel. Everybody's on YouTube or Instagram or wherever. You know, there's a million channels that you can watch. So I don't know if you have that common hit single kind of, you know, place that the Beatles took or Led Zeppelin took. I mean, is there a number one hit single anymore? There's so many different kinds of music now that people listen to because they have access to so much more.
Well, I think Taylor Swift is what you would probably have the closest
to. Well, she's pretty big.
Yeah, she's pretty, but yeah, I kind of heard that name somewhere before. Yeah, I think this Taylor Swift girl that I'm sort of hearing about. But no, yeah, she sort of defied the odds. I'm not sure exactly how she did it, but she's doing it. But I still don't see her like a Lennon or any of the ones that you think of from the past that were just kind of doing something that nobody did before.
Nobody spoke their mind the way Lennon did, and nobody summed up what people were thinking. Because one time John told me that somebody in Canada, I think, had asked him to do an advertisement. He thought that was ridiculous. He said, if I tried to tell people what kind of toothpaste to use, they'd laugh at me. And he actually said, I don't have a talent to tell people what to do. But he said, I can sum up what people are thinking in a few short words or a few, you know, just a sentence. You know, the idea of a phrase like, give peace a chance, or all we are saying is give peace a chance, is something that everybody can say and everybody thinks and everybody desires. But before John actually put those words together in that order, nobody ever said it that way.
You're right.
And now everybody says, just give peace a chance.
You're right.
You know, or imagine all the people living life in peace. He had a very simple way of summing up what everybody's already thinking and kind of giving them the words to express themselves.
You're right. Like,
telling them what to think. But people like him because he gave them the words to express what they were already thinking.
That's well put. You're right. Absolutely. And he kind of put it in a way that was accessible to everyone. Instead of talking above them, he talked to them.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I love that. Now, where do you see the music industry going, in your opinion, in the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, you've seen the evolution. Where do you kind of think it's going to be going with AI and all of these crazy things that are coming out? Where do you think it's going to go?
I'm not a critic and I don't make predictions. I just, you know, I'm fascinated and I keep my eyes open and I'm looking to watch. I actually saw an interesting thing the other day with Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about music, where they were saying that singing and the sound, rhythmic sound of music came before language. Before people invented words, they just exchanged sounds. Mm. And music is actually the oldest communication that people have. Yeah. You know, that they started making rhythms, hitting logs with sticks, made a drum, you know. And actually, I think they said on that broadcast that one of the oldest artifacts that people have found, like 40,000 years old, they found bone flutes, where somebody actually took a hollow bone and carved little holes in it at just the right places to make musical notes.
Wow.
So music goes back that far. So I'm sure it's going to go ahead as far as long as there's people, there's going to be music.
I agree. It's a universal
language. People whistle
language.
While they work, you know?
Universal language that we can all understand. Yeah. We may not always agree about things, but we understand it.
You don't have to listen to a singer. You can just whistle while you work, make up your own sounds.
Yeah. You know, and some of the people I know, they should not sing so much. Maybe they should whistle.
Some people should just hum.
They're good in the shower. That's good. Yeah. Or in the car. That's fine. You know, keep it there.
But if they enjoy it, they should do it.
Absolutely. Makes you happy, do it.
Clear.
Yeah. Now, what is, you've taken, how many photos do you think, if you could estimate in your whole body of art that you actually printed and you would consider part of a collection of your work, how many do you think you've done over the past 50 years?
Oh, well, I made millions. I don't know how many pictures, you know, that we've printed, but I have a collection of my better pictures that I call the rockers that I've had in my books, and that's more than 600 pictures.
Wow.
There, so I've taken a lot of good ones.
Oh, yes, you have now. I know it's like children, and I know it's like when you ask a musician, what's your favorite song? Do you have one, though, that if you were to say, like, this is the one, this is me, this is the thing that I just love?
Well, you know, they asked me to make a list of records one time of 10, top 10, and it went to 25 because I have a 1A, 1B, 1C.
You have runner up.
The picture of John Lennon or the picture of Tina Turner or the picture right behind me of the Clash is a pretty good one.
Yeah. What's your favorite?
John Lennon, the New York City picture or the Statue of Liberty picture, or the one of him and Yoko hugging. I got a lot of good pictures. I can't pick one.
But what's your favorite, though? That makes your heart just skip a beat.
I like them all. You know, so it really is like having kids. You can't pick a favorite. They're all different. And a lot of them are I look at it and go, wow, I'm really happy I took that picture. It's really, you know, people like it.
We're very happy you took those photos, too. I must say thank you for doing that and giving us these forever images that will be pop culture history. I mean, we'll be seeing these. People will be seeing these for hundreds of years in the future.
Well, I never expected it to be like that. And when I was taking the pictures and you put them in a magazine, you have no idea if people read it or if it matters to anybody. But I was actually in a grocery store about a week ago and a guy stopped me. I was at the cashier and a guy came up. He said, "Well, Mr. Gruen, I just want to thank you for entertaining me and giving me enjoyment for my whole life."
Mm.
And I, really? He goes, "Yeah, your pictures have meant so much to me." Mm. And that is very, very rewarding to have somebody just come up out of the blue and thank me.
Oh, well, I can't top that. So I think we probably have to end this interview because I don't think we can make anything better than what you just said, because that is what it's all about. And you are an extremely talented visionary. I want to see what's next for you. I know that I want people to pick up your memoir. It's The Right Place, Right Time, The Life of a Rock and Roll Photographer. I know that they should also go see Rock and Roll Exposed, the photography of Bob Gruen. And also just go to BobGruen.com and follow you and figure out, like, I know you do a lot of collections, a lot of showings, and just come go see the work in person. It's a beautiful thing to see.
Okay. And I update my Instagram page pretty frequently, too.
Oh, wonderful.
My website is funny. When we went to lockdown, I wasn't going anywhere. I didn't update the website for a long time. But then in August, I put up 4 new pages that covered the whole last 3 years. So, because it actually turned out I was doing a lot of things.
Oh, well, yes, I think you're a little busy.
Yes. Yeah, well, you can see it all on my website, BobGruen.com, and check out the Instagrams. I usually just do anniversaries and things like that.
Beautiful. And happy anniversary today, 50 years, that you go celebrate somewhere, do something fun. Go to the Statue of Liberty, maybe, and have a glass or something.
Oh, nowadays you got reservations to get out there.
That's true. It's not so easy anymore. Oh, well, thank you so much for spending time with me. This was fascinating. And any other time, you know, you have anything else you'd like to promote, please come on my show and think of us.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Hopefully I'll put out some more books soon.
Yes, I would love that. And I can't wait to read your next.
All right. I look forward to meeting you somewhere soon.
Yes, I like that too. We're very close, Philly and New York. So definitely we will catch up. And if I'm in the city, I'll hit you up.
Okay, definitely. I'm here. My studio's in the village.
Definitely. You could take a photo of me. I won't subject you to that, though.
Oh, easy.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You have a wonderful day.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you to my guest today, the wonderful Bob Gruen. And thank you again for tuning in to The Scene with Doreen. I'm here every week across the country bringing you the best interviews from the entertainment world and beyond. Get connected with me on social media and on the official website, thescenewithdoreen.com. And also make sure to tune in next week so you can find out what's going on. Bye.